All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Dana Buckler Show. My name is Dana.
And I'm Kristen.
And we are very excited to talk to you about a movie we just saw, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But before we do that, I think we have to talk about the fact that I went and saw a movie.
Well, and with somebody else, and have never one time in your life apparently had a good experience doing so.
Yes, yes. Very long-time listeners of the show are going to be well aware that I have a continuing list of episodes called The Movie Theater Rant, where I talk about these notoriously bad experiences that have happened to me. And most of them take place at the movie theater that you and I went to today.
So, Dana, I have to kind of touch on that because I am a big fan of that and those episodes as well. And the pressure that I felt prior to going to a movie with Mr. Dana Buckler, knowing what I know about you and your experiences, I'm thinking to myself, how is this going to be? Is he going to, like, buy all the nachos so no one else can eat them and make crunching noises? Is there going to be, you know, very drastic seating positions and moving around the theater often if somebody sits too close? The observations are, I was very anxious to see what was going to happen.
Absolutely. And we recorded a little intro video, which is available on the Twitter page at Dana Buckler Show right now, where I just basically let everybody know, hey, we're going to do this. I'm going to go see a movie. And then towards the end of the video, you pop in just to announce to everybody that I'm not going by myself. And what I thought was really interesting is when we first met at the theater, you know, the first thing you said is, all right, so what's your first ritual? What's the first thing that you have to do?
And I'm fully expecting a ritual.
And I'm just sort of saying, well, just take it one step at a time. Let's see what happens. And we get our tickets. Where do we sit?
Well, actually, what really happened, though, you already had two tickets prior to me ever deciding to go with you to this movie. So I'm actually expecting to get there and have to buy my own two tickets separately because I know you bought two. So specifically, no one will sit near you.
I know. And I just said, you know what? I'm just going to throw caution to the wind, let the chips fall where they may. And I said, you know, please, I can get through this. You can sit next to me.
Well, challenge accepted. We are friends, and I think that if anyone can do it, it's two friends through a movie that
absolutely
can get
and,
through it.
But we didn't. And you know what? Here's, ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you about some breakthroughs that happened today at this particular screening of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. For the first time in I don't know how many years, we changed seats. We moved to a different seat.
We did.
Because there wasn't a lot of people in the theater, and I'm sort of sitting on the inside seat and I'm just sort of looking at you and I'm going, I guess we could move to the middle of the theater if this place doesn't get packed or anything. And you're like, let's do it.
Yeah, well, and I suggested it. And then I'm thinking, gosh, I'm going to throw Dana off by suggesting we move because it's probably a tradition to sit here. And
it's always been those same two seats. And what was interesting is we live in a world now where it's assigned seating. So those seats were picked out. So I'm like, okay, here's what's going to happen. I'm gonna say, all right, let's move up here.
I'm the rebel over here influencing that idea. That's something that, yeah.
Exactly. And we're gonna move over here. And then we're going to end up inevitably sitting in seats that were already reserved for somebody else. And you could tell just from my body language, the trailers are playing. And you could see every time new people walked in, you saw me sort of tense up like, all right, here's the moment. And I can't even focus on the trailers because I'm watching people walk up the aisles going, oh, this is it. And then one lady literally stops right next to us. Right. And you pointed out that she had the nachos. And
oh, yeah.
And there was these ladies that were talking before the preview started. And mm-hmm. like all the indications that something was going to go terribly wrong. All where they were there.
So, and I haven't even asked you yet because this is the first time that you and I have actually sat here and discussed any part of our experience. I mean, we did not even speak to each other the whole movie.
Not at all.
So this is the first time, and I never even asked you, was this a positive experience?
It was.
Wow.
It truly was. I couldn't believe it, to be honest with you.
So we broke the curse.
I think the curse may have been broken. It's pretty incredible, to be honest with you. Nothing went wrong.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the people that were joining us in the theater, because I found that to be quite interesting. Wasn't quite expecting to see a whole bunch of older ladies, which looks like they just came from brunch to watch a Quentin Tarantino movie.
And I would say, because I'm 41, you're a few years younger than me. We were the youngest people in that theater by 20 years. Easily.
Yes.
Easily. And I looked at you and I said, all right, that group of ladies right over there, the over-under on them leaving is 35 minutes. Within 35 minutes, they're going to leave. And we'll get into it. But to be fair, those ladies were troopers.
Most of them toughed it out. I think we only had, and you pointed out there was only one person that walked out.
Yeah, one person. I did observe one person leave the theater and not return. What was also interesting is we made a deal with each other. Now, we're almost 2 hours out from seeing this film, and we made a deal that we would not say a word to each other about this film. Not did you like it? Nothing at all until we literally hit the record button right now. And this has been a tough 2 hours because you and I both like to talk. and when it comes to movies, that's all we ever talk about is movies. Literally, whenever we chat, it's always movie related. So to go see a new Quentin Tarantino film and have this 2 hour moratorium, if you will, on not being able to talk, it was excruciating.
It was the hardest part of my day, for sure. It was the hardest thing I've had to do in a very long time.
So, well, we're 6 minutes into this episode, and I know that most people, I mean, listen, I know a lot of people are tuning in to hear, they're happy that, you know, good theater experience, everything went well, but the title of this episode is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and people want to hear our thoughts on this movie. So, and believe me, I've got lots of thoughts, and I know, Kristen, you do too.
I do.
Just to let everybody know, we're going to keep this spoiler-free for a little bit. We will, of course, let you know when we get into spoilers, which, to be honest with you, I was mentioning to you, the one thing I was able to say to you was, we really can't talk a lot about this movie until we get into spoilers, you know, but we can just give our overall impressions. Now, Kristen, before I ask you just your initial overall impression of this film, I want to preface this by saying that, like, I spend a lot of time on social media promoting the show. I spend a lot of time on Twitter, Instagram, and I'm reading some initial feedback from people. And I was finding that there was much more sort of divisive thoughts about this film. And I was seeing people that were saying, you know, this is completely different from anything Tarantino's ever done, and I'm not sure if I like this. And you and I spoke yesterday a little bit about that, and I said, oh, well, you know, it's Tarantino, you know, for lack of a better term, he's an abstract filmmaker. What is your initial impression of this movie?
So my initial impression is that it is very different from Quentin Tarantino movies in the past. It's definitely a new layout of a movie, a new presentation of a story than he is known for. However, I would say that the part for me that is the most different is the beginning, because he really puts you into a time period rather than kind of shoving it down your throat, or rather than just letting you assume what it feels like to grow up in the 60s or to be a part of that whole late 60s hippie vibe, you know, in Los Angeles, California during that time. So I think he does an excellent job by really putting the viewer into a time in history. So it is slower, because you don't do that by having massive fights and blood and guts and or explosions. Or he doesn't force feed it to you. He lets you watch it as if you were almost walking into a time period. And he does that by showing clips of television programs and movies and really getting into some things that I can definitely see people that have seen it that would think that was maybe very boring or slow or not typical. But I don't know. I disagree. I mean, I think it's not typical of his style, but I think that it's probably typical of his character to want to tell a story that is portrayed in a way that the viewer gets to put themselves in a time frame. And I would say he nailed it.
It's interesting, because that's an interesting way to look at it. There was a couple things that ran through my mind when the movie was over. Something I said to you right before the movie started was that every Tarantino film has shocking moments. Has what the fuck, oh my God, moments in it. And I think I feel comfortable saying, and this is not a slight against the movie, but if that's what you're going into, if you're going in for those crazy, over-the-top moments that Tarantino was famous for, I think you're going to be a little let down. Because, yes, there are a few of those moments, but they're very few and far between, and they certainly have weight to them, because you've gotten to know the character so well. But this movie for me was very, to say it's a slow burn, I think is probably the easiest way to describe it. It's a movie that really, really takes its time.
It does.
And that's the thing about this, is it really takes my time. And I can tell you this, Kristen, when I saw Inglourious Basterds in the theater in 2009, I walked out of the box office, turned right back around, and bought another ticket because I couldn't wait to see that movie again. Didn't feel that way about Django. I like Django. I think Django is a great movie. Didn't feel that way about The Hateful Eight the first time I saw it, and I think The Hateful Eight is one of his masterpieces. So here's my thing. When we walked out of the theater, I'm sitting there saying, well, how quickly do I want to see this again? And the answer is, I don't know. I think I need to really let this digest for a little bit because I understand the divisiveness that people are talking about now. This is complicated for me to really tell you how I feel about this movie because we're 2 hours out and there's some amazing things in this film. But there are some, in some parts, I think it does drag a little bit.
Well, it does. But at the same time, for me, and this is my opinion on it, I think it's supposed to. I think that in 1969, things did drag a little bit. And I think a lot of his other movies and time frames, of course, there are some examples like Inglourious Basterds, which is happening during a war. So that's a little bit different as far as the element of your situation that you're in for the movie. This is just the summer of 68, 69. You know, I mean, this is a town where it is slower. People are not moving at a fast pace. Hippies are lining up on the streets and digging through dumpsters and peace and love and chill, you know, and the movie puts you into that time frame. So I'm thinking, for maybe what he was trying to do. I mean, I don't know, but this is how it made me feel. So the way that that movie made me feel when I watched it is like I was being put into 1969, the summer in Hollywood. And so Pulp Fiction was one of my all-time favorite movies ever. And that movie takes place in a time period, I guess, where, I guess that would be like current day, right? Like 90, takes place in the 90s.
94.
So, yeah. It felt like the 90s. You go to these restaurants where they're having the dance competitions, and he does have those elements paying a tribute to a different time. But I like that it was slow. I can't say that I expected it to be that slow. Right. But I enjoyed it and appreciated it because it gave me a chance to really try and put myself in that time period. I do think that the elements that are truly Quentin Tarantino, like the way that the movie starts out where they're driving in the car and the cameras are in the back and you're riding in the back seat of the car, that is so Quentin Tarantino. And I love that Cliff drove a Carmangia convertible because that's like my all-time favorite. They called it the poor man's Porsche. But gosh, I just love that car. The classic cars, the music, I loved it. I really loved it, but it was very slow and it took a while to really, I guess, figure out what he was trying to do in the beginning. Like, where was this going to go? I had no idea.
And I agree. I think you're really nailing it with your initial breakdown of how the best way to describe this film. And there are Tarantino signatures throughout this movie. This one, again, I want to stress that I'm not ready to say this. I didn't enjoy this movie because by the time we sort of get to the third act of the film, I mean, I'm all in. I am so invested in these characters. I'm so invested. And you said something interesting about, you know, it's sort of 1969, it's the summer of 69. And he does a wonderful job of, one, making it very authentic. Like, at no point did this seem like it was a modern day setting. Like, he did a great job. I mean, kudos to the art department, the production designers, the attention to detail. I mean, it's staggering. You know, when they're driving down the Sunset Strip, I mean, I was purposely looking, saying, all right, do I see anything modern? I don't see anything modern. So he did a really, really good job of establishing and creating this world. It's funny because I had the same thoughts about The Hateful Eight after I saw it the first time. I was like, that was interesting. But, you know, in subsequent reviews of the film, rewatches, if you will, like, I just fell in love with it because I think here's the thing about Tarantino films. I don't care who you are. You go in with a preconceived expectation of what the film is going to be. You think you know what it's going to be just based on the trailer, based on the subject matter. And we'll get into that when we get into spoilers. And then he does, you know, that subverts your expectations. 100% of the time, he's always done that with every film. And he's done it again with this movie. He has completely subverted at least my expectations. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying when I walked out of the theater, I was very conflicted, like I have been with numerous Tarantino films.
Right, me too. I mean, I can't think of a single one that I have not had to watch more than one time to fully appreciate it in the way that it's meant to be appreciated. I don't think his movies are a one and done type of film.
We need to talk just a little bit about, I just want to talk, before we get into spoilers, I just want to talk about the principal cast here. I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio, again, has the guy ever turned in a bad performance in the past 20 years? He's outstanding as the character of Rick Dalton, who was a, you know, the movie quickly establishes, and we're staying spoiler free here for a little bit. The movie establishes that he was a television actor in the 1950s, very popular Western that he was on. And he is going through this transition where Hollywood is changing. You know, the Western is dying out. And he finds himself in the situation where he's just doing weekly guest spots on popular television shows, but he's always playing the bad guy. And he's really trying to find his – he thinks he's washed up. He thinks he's a has-been. And DiCaprio really, really pulled that off. What did you think about him?
I did. I mean, I thought so too. And I think that he did such a great job right in the first scene with him. He really does a great job of showing the difference between, you know, him in an interview in the beginning and his television personality, and then – switching to him actually talking with his friend who, or his driver, his stunt double, who is of course played by Brad Pitt. I mean, he just does an excellent job communicating to Brad Pitt's character, Cliff, his insecurities. And instantly I saw a character that went from this famous, this big personality, TV star confidence to immediately having self-doubt, total just loss of direction in his life. And you really see that feeling and that shift. And the way that that was presented right off the bat, I thought was really great. And for an actor to be able to show that kind of character change so quickly, and it's so believable, I was impressed right off the bat with that, for sure.
Which you've got to think that that's something that's probably still goes on today. Except, you know, all the really famous people live in a social media world where they're in front of something 24/7. And what I thought was interesting is, you know, he has, like you said, he has this television persona and he has this personality, but on the inside, you know, he's a terribly scared individual. He's scared that I'm going to be a has-been. I'm all washed up. There's nothing left for me. And, you know, we get into spoilers. We'll talk a little bit more about, you know, some of the decisions that he makes. Of course, we have to talk about Brad Pitt, which I can tell you easily was my favorite character of the movie. Like, I just thought he was awesome in this movie. And how can you not love Brad Pitt? Here's a guy that's 55 years old, still looks terrific. His character, Cliff Booth, he's been the stuntman for Rick Dalton for many, many years. And their friendship is like they're brothers, basically. And, you know, he is always supporting Rick no matter what.
Yeah.
And
their friendship really comes through and shines through immediately.
And it's, I mean, there's a line of dialogue in there where, you know, at one point Rick says, I can't afford to pay you anymore. So you understand that he does technically work for him, but Cliff is the only person that Rick can truly confide in.
Yeah.
And you get that within like the first few minutes of the movie. Like, you understand the dynamic between the two.
And not to overplay the Brad Pitt is super sexy card, because obviously that one's been played a million times before, but man, they make a comment even in the movie. You're the best looking stunt double. You're too pretty to be a stunt double. And yeah, he's still a handsome man. He can pull it off for sure.
And what I really liked was he had this kind of low key charisma about him. Whenever he would talk to anybody, he had a cool confidence about him. You know, there's a scene that I won't say until we get into spoilers, but there's a scene where he has a conversation with Bruce Lee, and there is just this confidence about him that he's ultimately able to back up. And you just realize that this is a guy that has been through some shit. And I, you know what? We should just get into spoilers at this point. I mean, we keep skirting around the issue here, so.
We do.
So what we're just.
Before we get into spoilers, I have one quick question.
Please.
So I know we've talked about general first impressions. Mm. Would you say that this is a movie that you liked? Did you like it? Did you love it?
I have to say that I liked it because I think the mark of a really good movie and a really interesting movie is one that I can't stop thinking about. I go see a Marvel movie and I'm one and done and that's it and I don't give a shit and we'll move on to the next one. Who cares? This movie, I'm walking out of the theater and the fact that I'm so conflicted in how I'm thinking and challenge, it's such challenging material, that's a sign of a really good movie, because if a movie really invokes those kind of emotions out of me, then yeah, how can I not like it? So yeah, ultimately, I do like this. And we'll get into the end with how strong of a recommendation we give these movies. But
right.
But what same question to you. Like, what did you – I mean, did you like this movie?
I mean, I loved it. I did love it. I can't say I loved everything about it, but I really loved it. And I loved the fact that it felt like watching – like a piece of artwork with the architecture and the design and just the overall beauty of the film. To me, that was one of my favorite parts. The whole scenery of Los Angeles in the 60s is its own character in this movie. And I love that.
Oh, yeah. And Los Angeles is a character in this movie. Make no mistake about it. We're going to get into spoilers right now.
Let's do it.
We're going to work on the assumption that, you know, if you don't want, and when I say there's some major spoilers in this movie, we're going to get into them right now. So, spoilers.
So if you haven't seen it, shut it off.
So if you haven't seen the movie, and if you're planning on seeing it, I want you to hit pause right now. Just keep a note of how far into the episode you are, and then come back and listen to Kristen and I talk a little bit more about this movie afterwards. But for everybody else, we're going to say spoilers in 3, 2, 1. Okay, we have to talk about Margot Robbie's character. We have to talk about Sharon Tate, because that was sort of the big controversy about this movie. How was Tarantino going to handle the fact that he's cast Margot Robbie to play Sharon Tate? Now, before we get into the conclusion of the movie, I just want to tell you that I fucking fell in love with Margot Robbie in this movie. And there's a scene when she goes to the movie theater to watch a movie that she's in with Dean Martin. She's getting such a high from the audience reactions. And it's so cute. She puts on these big glasses, which she would never wear in public. She even tells the lady at the box office, you know, I'm in the movie.
Oh, yeah. They didn't believe her at first. It was so funny.
They have her take pictures. And then they bring her in. And then the guy who's running the theater is like, no, Miss Tate, come on in. And, you know, there was some complaints that Margot Robbie's not in the movie very much. Well, this isn't her story.
Correct. And that's something that I was very curious to see how she was going to be portrayed and what was going to happen as far as Sharon Tate in the movie, because that was a big part of what happened in 1969 as we know it. However, this movie isn't taking place as we know it. And Sharon Tate is an up and coming new actress, not recognizable. And I think that Quentin Tarantino did an excellent job of portraying a very irrelevant at the time actress, because at that time, in history, she wasn't all that relevant. She was very little known. She was a beautiful angel of a woman. And I think he was able to portray her kindness and her goodness, her just overall goodness in nature so well in that movie that she did not need several speaking lines. It wasn't a movie about her. It was a movie about Cliff and Rick and their friendship and his career. So the movie wasn't about Sharon Tate. And I was curious before watching it, because the one thing I had heard was that people were not happy with the way that Sharon Tate was portrayed and that he underutilized her. But I disagree on that 100%. I think that he absolutely maximized Sharon Tate to the audience in the best possible way, because the audience is smart. He gave the audience enough credit to know who Sharon Tate was and is, you know, was and was during that time period. And during that time period, she wasn't somebody that was popular to the common person. She wasn't recognizable. So I really think he did an excellent job with her character, because she played the perfect Sharon Tate for that time.
And just to sort of second what you said there, watching the movie, all right, I was able to understand the type of personality that Sharon Tate had. I was able to understand the kindness that she had. Like you said, she's very few lines in this movie. That's true. And just to be honest with you, like, I thought that Sharon Tate was in this movie more than I expected her based on everything that I was reading.
Oh, yeah, me too. I mean, she was in it a lot more than I thought, visually. And she had more speaking parts than I would have expected based on what I heard as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I want to talk about one thing as far as the women in this movie. So when I had read about Sharon Tate not being in it enough and her character, the lines being underutilized and Margot Robbie being underutilized as a character, I mean, I do disagree with that. I think that they used Margot Robbie perfectly, because there's no one else that I could ever imagine to play Sharon Tate ever. I mean, she is like the most perfect representation of that, for one. For two, I think that women in general in this movie are portrayed extremely strong. And I had heard, you know, that, gosh, you know, Quentin Tarantino doesn't portray women that strong, and he doesn't give them the spotlight more, or he doesn't give them enough powerful things to say. Well, I completely disagree. In this movie, I think every female character was a strong representation of a woman, even the hippie chicks, you know, who aren't ideal role model type women, of course, but they have a strong persona. And then there's that young, the girl, the child actress, mm-hmm. during the filming, when Rick is filming one of those episodes. So when he was filming the pilot episode, that younger girl, her strength as a 8-year-old child, I think she said she was 8, and her character and the way that she was able to deliver a feeling and represent a strong young woman that you can just tell she will be someone growing up in Hollywood. She will be someone famous. And I kept thinking to myself, gosh, I really wonder who that actress is, you know? Who is that? Because she's going to be somebody. And you can just tell by how strong and how committed to the role she was. And I really liked the way that, you know, Zoe Bell, her character is this tough chick that she's wearing the Mary Tyler Moore like pants, you know, and she's represented, I think, very strong. And I think Quentin Tarantino does have respect for women. And I think that that came across in this movie more so than any other one I've ever seen.
Yeah, no, you're right. And just to touch on that, that young actress again, she's really good. And how you can tell she's really good is Tarantino does a lot of these long single takes. And she is playing opposite Leonardo DiCaprio in scenes that go on for 2 or 3 minutes uninterrupted. And she nailed it. So, yeah, she's going to be somebody. She's on her way.
But even in the movie, though, like that actress, because I did feel the sense or the need to, I guess, with each character. Because they had a mix of so many real people, Steve McQueen and just to name and Bruce Lee. So there's so many real people. And then, of course, there are fictional people as well. Rick and Cliff are both fictional characters, probably loosely based on someone. And I gotta say this, my favorite, the opening scene when they're backing out of the driveway and you see the rear view mirror and there's the picture of himself hanging on the wall, which is pretty vain. But that picture that's hanging on the wall and the way that the rear view mirror is positioned, it almost looks like a big mustache. And my first thought was, oh, maybe it's Burt Reynolds.
Maybe it's Burt Reynolds.
Like, it just, the look of that gave me that sense of, I bet you that's a big tribute to a big, thick mustache right there. So whoever actor that was loosely based on, if it was even, that would be my first guess. But I do think that every character in that movie, including that young girl, I wonder who that was supposed to be loosely based on in real life. If there is a young actor that came up from the late 60s and started out method acting in the 60s when it wasn't even really a thing, you know? So it really sucked me into each character, that movie, tied me to each character and wanting to know more about every single person that I saw on screen.
And a couple things I just want to point out. One, I thought it was really interesting when Sharon Tate, when Margot Robbie's in the theater watching her movie, that was the real Sharon Tate movie they were watching.
Oh, yeah. Like that. On screen, that was Sharon Tate.
Throughout the movie, they do a lot of clips where you see Leonardo DiCaprio, Rick Dalton. He's in famous movies like The Great Escape and things like that. And you see him interspliced, you know, obviously digitally with the real movies. But the fact that he chose to show Sharon Tate, the real Sharon Tate movie on screen, I thought that was really interesting. They just look so much alike, too. Like, it's
a perfect, they really do. I love that when she was sitting in the movie, and as that scene comes on, I am literally sitting in the exact same position with my feet up on the chair. And my feet are probably just as dirty as hers were. Like, the bottoms of her feet are clearly, you know, dirty. It's funny.
We have to talk about the ending of this movie, because the biggest controversy going into this film was the fact, and I've mentioned it earlier in this episode, that, you know, part of the story revolves around Sharon Tate. Now, Rick Dalton is his next door neighbors, Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. That's the house they live in. And the entire third act of this movie is building to that night on August 8th, 1969. The date is sprawled across the screen. And when we get to that date, you see the times. The time keeps forward. You've got Kurt Russell narrating what's happening. And, I mean, we're already into spoilers. So I have to ask you, you see the Manson family show up. You know, they talk about they've been instructed to go to this house. They've been instructed to kill everyone. They go to the wrong house. They go to Rick's house.
But they go to Rick's house because it's not a true story. And the way that that story with him coming out with the pitcher of margaritas, I'm sure that that inspired them to say what the girl said in the back seat. And that was an awkward scene. I felt like that was an awkward scene.
Super uncomfortable.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable because they were talking like regular people. And it's one of those types where people that are, you know, terrible people that are in jail, as someone that just on their everyday life, you don't look at those people as someone that you could relate to in any way or that you want to hear what they have to say necessarily about a situation, especially before it happens. You know what's going to happen. We know that they're coming there to kill somebody. So I think that him coming out in the street and yelling at them for being there and get the fuck out of here, you know, that's what shifted the gears. They were headed to that one house. And then that's where the story takes a turn.
And what's interesting is right before the movie started, I said, I want to make a bold prediction. And I said, my bold prediction for this movie is that it will not show the Sharon Tate murder. Now, I truly in my heart of hearts believed that we were going to see the aftermath. I thought perhaps we were going to see the crime scene where everybody is dead. But my bold prediction was that we would not see the murder. And ultimately, that turned out to be true.
And not in the way that you thought, maybe, but it did turn out to be true. And my prediction was that Charles Manson wasn't going to be a significant character in any way.
You were correct.
And that was correct as well. You see him for 2 seconds. Yeah, I mean,
you were very correct about
maybe
that.
Maybe 2 minutes, but not long. And I think that it was creepy that, you know, you can just tell that's exactly who that is.
Yeah. I mean, there was no, I mean,
they never say it either.
They never say, you just, yeah, you knew.
But that
right
was
away.
Him.
And what's interesting about that, you know, this whole reason why Charles Manson showed up at this house, because it was the house before Roman Polanski moved in there. It was one of the producers who worked with the Beach Boys, and Charles Manson wanted to, he wanted to be a singer.
Wasn't he friends with the drummer in real life?
Yeah. And so he, you know, Manson was trying to get a record produced. And that's why he ended up showing up at the house earlier on in the movie, because he was looking for these particular people, but they had since moved out. So that really happened. Like that's why that house was targeted.
Right. Exactly. And if I'm not mistaken, the Beach Boys actually did record one of Charles Manson's songs, and it was a flop.
I believe that to be true. The fact of the matter is, like other Tarantino films, I'm looking at Inglourious Basterds specifically, what we get is an alternative history.
Yes.
Because in the end of Inglourious Basterds, Hitler is killed in the – spoiler alert if you haven't seen Inglourious Basterds, but Hitler's killed. He's killed at the end. All the high-ups in the Nazi regime are killed at the end of that movie. Based on how this movie was being presented – throughout the entire run of the film, that was the twist that I never saw coming.
Nope, I didn't either. And you felt that tension in certain scenes, like when Charles Manson shows up to Roman Polanski's house and Sharon Tate is there. And I think it was Jay Sebring that opened the door. And, you know, he's looking for that producer guy, like you mentioned. And you can tell that that's him. They never say that it's him. But the tension that I felt with her walking towards the door, and then when they closed the door, and we all know history and what was written on that. I mean, how that all went down. And you see the front of that door with nothing on it. And, you know, gosh, I mean, I know for me, that's the only time I've ever seen that door without blood on it. I mean, so it was very eerily just poking at the future, like just creepily creeping into the storyline of this is where it's going to go. We're going there. And then all of a sudden, we're not going there.
No. And what's interesting, again, is this is a long movie. It's 2 hours and 45 minutes long. And I actually text a friend of mine. He said, how is it? I said, well, I'm going to be honest with you. You feel how long this movie is. Unlike other Tarantino films, which I think move along at a pretty good clip, I think you feel the length in this movie. How that's going to translate in subsequent viewings, I don't know. But when we sort of get to the August 8th, we get to that date, the infamous date, I sort of sat up in my seat a little bit. Like, I was starting to dread the idea of what was going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
I was really getting apprehensive, and a little bit of anxiety was coming over me, because I've read, you and I have talked about it, we've researched, we've looked into what happened at the Sharon Tate house, what happened at Roman Polanski's house that night, and it's brutal, and it's not something we don't even need to get into. I mean,
I like a good graphic, gory scene more than most people probably, but I know, even for me, and I'm pretty dark with some stuff, with what I enjoy, but I did not want to have to watch that.
No.
And I'm really glad that he didn't take it down that road, because I didn't want to have to watch that. I mean, what a tragedy in history. And I'm glad that he stayed away from it. I'm glad that he still showed the thought process of the Manson family. I'm glad that he still had a attempted murder. You know, I'm glad that he still showed an end that was, I mean, frankly, I'm glad there was some violence. I'm just really glad that it didn't involve a true story violence, because I don't think that that's something Quentin Tarantino, like you mentioned with Inglourious Basterds, he is kind of steered away from the facts when it came to the gore, because the facts are the facts. The audience knows what happened in history. This is a movie.
Yeah. And this is, we can say this now with this is a pure work of fiction.
Correct.
This movie is a work of fiction. It's like the title says, Once Upon a Time. It's a story.
It's a great title. And I think that he did such a amazing job creating, like, it felt like you're climbing into the DeLorean and going back to 1969. He did a fabulous job of putting me in that time period and then making it something completely different.
Yeah.
And that was, I think that takes a lot of skill. I was impressed with it. And yes, it was long. I like that it was long. I mean, were there some parts that were maybe a little longer than they needed to be? Probably. But Probably not, really. I have to watch it again to be sure of that, because I think that what Quentin Tarantino has always done in his movies is he makes them the best use of his time. Yeah. If it's going to be long, it's because he's filming a Western movie and you get to watch part of that movie. And that was cool. I liked how we got to be on the set of a movie within a movie, and then watching television on watching a movie on the big screen, and then watching television with the characters. And I really liked when they had the FBI program.
Yeah.
So everybody sits down and it's everyone, like everyone you talk to, they 6 o'clock, 6 p.m. sit down and watch FBI. Like, it's everyone.
Yeah.
And you get to be a part of it.
Even Bruce Dern's character, oh, yeah. You know, when they're at the ranch, even Bruce Dern, he's like, I got to watch FBI
yeah.
tonight.
Oh, yeah.
I've got, by the way, little side note on Bruce Dern. He was brought in last minute because that role was given to Burt Reynolds, who sadly passed away before he had an opportunity to film that. So,
you know, I love Bruce Dern.
Yeah. No, and he was great. He was great. It was, you know, a very, very minor part, but effective.
Effective for sure. Well, I really liked how they did the sound in the theater, which I don't know would translate. I don't know how that would come across if you watched it on television at home, but in the theater, when you are watching that program when they're watching FBI and everybody's sitting at the couch or at the, you know, in the room, in the living room, the sound of them talking about the show is coming from behind you. And it feels like you're almost a little kid sitting on the floor with people talking behind you on the couch watching a program. Yeah. And I loved that. I felt like that put you even more so within that world that Quentin Tarantino created.
The sound design was phenomenal, and I'm talking Oscar caliber design there. So with the ending of the movie, you get the three members of the Manson family. They break into Rick's house, and Cliff is tripping balls, basically, because he bought an acid-laced cigarette off one of the hippie chicks for 50 cents. He decides that's the night to smoke it. And I just thought it was great when they come in, and he says to Tex, you know, are you real? And the guy's like, it's just, I thought it was really, again, I cannot tell you how awesome Brad Pitt is in this movie. Like, he is the highlight of the movie for me. Like, I think he's the best part of this film.
I really enjoyed Brad Pitt. I do think, you know, let's not forget the part about how he supposedly killed his wife. So he is a war hero as well. And they mention that. And so people overlook that fact that he killed his wife because he's a war hero. Well, I would imagine that probably did happen. And kind of a nod, obviously, I think it's a very obvious nod to Natalie Wood at that part. She, even his wife on the boat, even says, my friend Natalie told me that you were a loser, you know. So it's a true nod to that whole scenario, but they never actually confirm or deny whether or not that happened.
They don't show it.
Correct.
But they show the setup. And that was a really interesting scene.
It was a little creepy. I found that to be creepy all by itself.
What I thought was interesting about this film, and we talk about how Tarantino, a lot of his films do time jumps. It's not a linear story being told. What I thought was interesting about this film, which was a little bit different, was a certain scenario gets talked about, and then they show you that scenario. Like when Cliff is trying to get Rick to get him hired on, he's like, well, I can't because, you know, Kurt Russell's like, he's part of it. And he says, no way. And then you see layers upon layers of why, you know, Cliff will never work with Kurt Russell's character again. And you get the entire scene with Bruce Lee, which was fucking awesome. I'm sorry. That whole scene with Bruce Lee, that was a little bit of a slight towards Bruce Lee. If I'm being honest here, like, he really sort of portrayed Bruce Lee as a really arrogant person. And I loved that. Not saying that Bruce Lee was.
Well, but I just can't wait to see Quentin Tarantino's movie about Bruce Lee next, because I would have to say that Mike Mo, he was Bruce Lee reincarnated on screen.
100%.
It was unbelievable. Down to just his little mannerisms. And that would make an interesting movie all on its own, I believe.
But I just thought it was hilarious when Cliff was like, listen, because they're asking, you know, could you beat Cassius Clay, who's Muhammad Ali? He hadn't changed his name to Muhammad Ali yet. So, and Bruce Lee's like, I destroy him. I'd cripple him. He said, I would cripple him. And Cliff just starts laughing. And he goes, you know, you're such a little guy. You're not going to, you know. And then I was like, when we're watching this, I'm going, oh, Brad Pitt's about to get fucked up by Bruce Lee. It's about to happen. But that's not what happened. And that just, again, made me just go, I fucking love Brad Pitt in this movie. Because the way he throws him into the car, like, it's incredible. It's incredible.
Yeah, it was incredible. And Brad Pitt did an excellent job of being a laid back person with like balls of steel. He was a badass, but he was the most laid back character in that whole movie. The most laid back, calm, even keel. Yeah.
Nothing
most even keel person. And then, but he would fuck some stuff up, man. He did not take any shit.
No.
He did not have, I mean, but you never would have, like, watching him throughout the whole movie, you don't get that vibe. And then all of a sudden, bam, he's going to fuck it up. And I really like that. I think that was a good balance. It was fun.
When they're at the ranch and he's leaving, know, and his tire has been, the guy stabbed his tire. And I'm thinking, I'm watching this going, okay, he's going to have to quickly change this tire and get the fuck out of there. And No, he tells the guy, hey, did you do that?
Tells him, yeah. And then he beats his ass.
He says, fix it. The guy's like, fuck you.
Yeah.
And he just beats his ass. And then he makes him fix, and then he fixes his tire and he leaves.
So I want to touch on the dialogue, the Quentin Tarantino dialogue, which is unmistakable in all of his movies. And, you know, Pulp Fiction is a great example, of course, of the back and forth with the conversation and the curse words and all that that are used poetically. Quentin Tarantino is one of the only people I can think of that can use every swear word out there and make it flow and sound completely natural and part of the story.
Yeah.
And that is, I like that. It's not for everybody, I'm sure, but it is for me, and I like it. And I think that it's a very rare gift that he has these actors and that they're able to have a conversation mostly in swear words and have it still come across as meant to be a natural. And I like how he does that. And I think he did a really good job of doing it in this movie, but toned down because it is 1969. A nod to him on that, because I appreciate the way that he did that.
And what I like about him, and he's always been able to do this with every performance he gets out of actors, is you don't see Leonardo DiCaprio on screen. You see Rick Dalton. And what I thought was interesting about with Rick's character is he had a bit of a stuttering problem.
Yeah, you know, and that really paints the picture of a lack of self-confidence.
Yeah,
that is true to who he is.
You know, people. Yeah, he would stutter when he wasn't feeling confident or comfortable about who he was, and I thought that was really interesting. You know, I didn't see the actors on screen, and that happens with every Tarantino film, and he just pulls these really unique, one of a kind performances out of these already really good actors, and that really translated on this one. Like the more we're talking about this movie, like the more I'm like, yeah, I mean, who am I kidding? I love this movie.
So I just don't think it would be fair to every woman, man listening right now to not mention that Brad Pitt takes off his shirt. And I have to say, I'm an adult and I don't know that I get excited about Brad Pitt taking his shirt off anymore. I'm not a teenager. I will say this. It was pretty exciting. He looked fabulous and holy shit. I was blown away. He is a handsome man. I gotta say, I
55 years old and he had a six pack. Like, no, don't kid yourself.
That's not just a saying about Brad Pitt being the handsomest guy. He sure does have a look.
But, and he was, to me, he was just like, he was so cool in this movie. Like, I went into this thinking that, you know, of course Leo was going to steal the show because he stole the show in Django. He was, to me, the best part of Django. But my goodness, did I walk away from this movie going, that Brad Pitt, that character was so awesome.
Yeah, it was.
And the way that whole final scene where it's basically him versus the Manson, those three Manson family people, how that scene, what I love about it is because it's Tarantino, you don't know how it's going to end.
Gosh, no, I did not expect that at all.
You don't know if Brad Pitt's going to survive. You don't know. That's what's called stakes. There are real stakes with this movie. And if I'm being blunt about the ending, I want to tell you how I was interpreting it. I genuinely thought when all of that was happening, when he was fighting with the Manson family in the house, I genuinely thought that this was a bad acid trip that he was having and that we were going to realize that that all never happened and they actually, in fact, went to Sharon Tate's house. That I kept waiting for that to happen, especially after the girl crashes through the screen door and goes into the pool and Rick gets the fucking flamethrower out.
I mean,
it's
perfect.
Lights her up. I'm like, okay, this is clearly an bad acid trip that he's having. But that wasn't the case. Like, it's...
No, the violence was there for sure. I mean, some parts definitely gave me made me cringe. You know, had to, like, shot me back in my chair, you know?
Absolutely.
It was bloody and violent for sure. And well-deserved, frankly. It almost felt like kind of a tribute to, if only this is how it could have ended up.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that is, as we all know, not the case. One thing I want to point out about the end that I also really like, a little... side, I guess, note is that pit bull was extremely well behaved and listened to absolutely everything that he said. And I just think that's a very nice, clear nod to how trainable those dogs could probably be.
What I thought was interesting is very quickly in the end credits before. So for listeners, if you're listening to this and you still haven't seen it, there is a mid-credit sequence, which is absolutely worth waiting around for.
Oh, yes.
But even before that, a big, giant Humane Society logo comes up and they're like, no animals were harmed during, like, they want to let you know that.
I know. Do they still have to say that? I mean, gosh.
But they were really putting it in your face.
Like, yeah, hey, they were. Like,
there was no animals harmed in this.
Well, that pit bull was a badass. And gosh, she was a good dog for sure.
And that end credit sequence is so... the end credit sequence where he's doing the red apple cigarettes at the very end, and they say cut, and he's like, these things taste like shit.
Oh, yeah. You totally see the snobby, yeah. Act. And look at this picture. Does nobody catch this? I have a double chin. Like, come on.
You know, I want to talk about, there was one part, there's a scene where Rick Dalton, he's decided he's going to go to Italy. He's going to Italy to do these spaghetti westerns. And this is an obvious reference. Sergio Leone, who did Once Upon a Time in the West, For a Few Dollars More, Fistful of Dollars, things like that. The Man with No Name trilogy and things like that. You know, because those were still very popular at that time. You have the narrator, who's Kurt Russell, talking about all the things he did. He's like, he did this one movie that was directed by Antonio Margherita.
Mm.
And I just said, oh, that was one of the characters in Inglourious Basterds, when they're at the movies and it's two of the bastards. One of them is Eli Roth. I can't remember the other actor's name. And Hans Lander keeps asking them, what's your name? And he's like, Antonio Margherita. And he keeps trying to do it. And so I said, oh, is, okay. So is this in the same universe? Because
but it is. Aren't we all in Quentin Tarantino? Yeah,
but spoiler alert, Antonio Margherita in the movie Inglourious Basterds doesn't survive. But he's this Italian, he's supposed to be this Italian guy. I just like little winks and nods like that, I thought were really interesting.
And I think, yes, and that's something that he does extremely well, because he obviously, he's the writer and the director, and he, of course, knows what he has already done. And I like how he pays tribute to his other films that are out there, because if you like one, I think you probably at least can appreciate them all.
Well, and the whole red apple cigarette thing, I mean, that's all people smoke in Tarantino films are red apple cigarettes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's right. I mean, that's when in Pulp Fiction, the first time Bruce Willis goes in to meet with Marsalis Wallace, he says, pack of red apples.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's, again, and the fact that he does this, and I love the fact that when he's doing that cigarette commercial, they keep saying it's smooth. You're not going to get a lot of throat
pain.
You're not going to get a lot of throat burn. And then you see Rick Dalton's, throughout the movie, he's constantly coughing.
Oh, yeah.
He's all fucked up. He's in really bad shape. And a lot of that's probably from smoking, obviously.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get the throat burn. Like, they kept emphasizing that.
So this is another little thing that I really liked. The dog food was rat flavored.
Yeah.
Like, what the heck?
It said dog food, something good food for mean dogs or something like it said on the can.
Yeah.
Like just little product, like fun little fake products that he puts throughout the movie.
Yeah.
It was really interesting.
So one thing I kind of want to point out that is creepy maybe for me to have noticed, but the end of the movie when, Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt have killed the Manson girls and Tex, and their cops have come and gone, and Cliff gets carried off in the ambulance. And then there's Jay Sebring at the gate. And he's, hey, what happened, man? What's going on down there? And that conversation was so eerie to me because at that moment in time in the world we live in, those people were no longer. And then you hear Sharon Tate come over on the intercom. And I just got goosebumps when that happened, because you hear her sweet, innocent voice and inviting him to come over and hang out and have a drink with me and my friends. And they're all still alive. And then they all meet in the driveway outside the house. And the clothes that they're wearing are all the same clothing. I mean, to a T, the clothing that they were wearing that night in actual crime scene pictures. And that gave me such a chill, like right down my spine, it gave me a chill. And I think that was some insane attention to detail on Quentin Tarantino's part. And I loved it. But man, was it chilling. And so I think that the movie was still able to end on a chilling note with a tribute to that.
I'm going to be very curious to see how the legs that this movie has throughout the years, because every Tarantino film, like when Jackie Brown came out, in 97, three years after Pulp Fiction. It wasn't as well received as Pulp Fiction. It was a vast departure from Pulp Fiction. 20 something years later, you know, it's considered one of his best films. You know, like these movies tend to get reevaluated every few years. And I'm going to be very curious to see how the legs that this movie has.
I agree. I have definitely seen that there are mixed reviews, and all I can say is I haven't read them because other than that thing about the women being portrayed poorly. But other than that, I haven't really sat down to read them. I wanted to wait till you and I had a chance to discuss it. But I want to sit down tonight and read through some. I'm just curious to see how other people perceive it. And if, you know, the message that I think he was trying to have come through on that film, I think was one of what if things had gone differently. And the beauty of movies is they can go whatever way he fucking says.
Yeah. To wrap this up, I'm just going to say that this was not the movie I was expecting to see. And that is not a complaint about the film. But it's an interesting world we live in now, because we have so much access to media and to speculation and rumors and everything.
Well, some of us do, Dana, not
right.
me.
Yeah. it's kind of unavoidable. And there was all these controversies. And when you finally see the movie, like, I cannot take people who bitch about something they've never seen serious. How can you? How can people say, how dare Tarantino even touch the Sharon Tate thing? Well, once you see the movie, you're going to have a completely different outlook about that. Like, if there's a big lesson I've learned after watching this movie is don't listen to anyone else. Make up your own mind. Watch it. And then you can decide whether or not you want to be upset. Because I don't think... Yeah. I think he handled the Sharon Tate thing rather eloquently.
I agree. I mean, you know me well enough to know that I'm always of that mindset with everything. I mean, I was raised by my father, and my father raised me to learn how to think, not what to think. I mean, to how to think for myself and form my own opinion based on the information that I have. And that's something that I've always done with everything. And based on all the information that I have from watching this movie myself, I think he did an excellent job. I can't wait to see it again.
Absolutely. We have a rating system that we want to introduce, and it's Hooked.
It's
our Hooked rating system.
A little tribute to Jaws, of you know. Course. I mean, torpedoes are a little, or not torpedoes, torpedoes are a little violent. Yeah. Harpoons are a little violent. So, yeah.
So
hooks.
It's a fish hook.
Should we do like 1 through 5?
Yeah, I think it's 1 through 5.
Okay. So, 5 being like massively hooked, like Jaws
like,
hooked.
Like 5, you've hooked the great white.
Yeah. All right? Okay.
1 is just the worm hanging off the hook.
Worm. I like it.
This, and I'm going to be honest with you. I am sure. I'm going to be blunt with you. I am sure that my opinion on this film will change over time. And I think it will change in a more positive direction than it is right now. And I'm feeling good about the film. So right now, I'm going to give this 4 out of 5 hooks.
Yep. I'm going to give it 5 out of 5 for me, because I really think he touched on everything. But I want to give it a 4 based on expectation.
Sure.
I did not expect it to go that way. It was surprising. I'm still digesting, but 5. I think that he hit all the elements that the way that he did. Yeah, no, 5.
Absolutely. All right. If you want to follow the show on social media, you can find us on Twitter at Dana Buckler Show. You can follow me personally on Twitter at Dana Buckler. There's an Instagram page set up, which is at The Dana Buckler Show. If you want to email the show with questions or comments, you can do so at thedanabucklershow@gmail.com. And do we want to announce that you're...
Yeah, no, Dana set up a Twitter account for me.
I did set up it's right now, it's at Flosshair, FLOSSHAIR, at Flosshair.
Picture something stuck in your teeth and there's nothing else to do. I mean, what do you do?
Exactly. So, Kristen, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. Thank you for going to the movie with me and letting me sit near you.
This was, as of right now... We're 1-0 with our movie-going experience.
Well, so whatever, give me a chance. I'll fuck it up, I'm sure.
whatever baggage that I
typically... Let me chew something crunchy.
Whatever baggage I typically bring to the theater, it looks like it was left behind this time. So thank you so much. This was it was an overall great experience, and I'm glad I got an opportunity to see this movie with you. I'm glad I got an opportunity to talk to you. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And my name is Dana Buckler, and thank you so much for listening.